This is Positive Parenting. Parenting expertise and advice from best-selling parenting author and national newspaper columnist, Mr. Dad, Armin Brott.
Hello and welcome to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. If you ask Tim Dowling what his decision to get married was like, he would say, it was less like a proposal and more like an agreement that was made with the resigned determination of two people plotting to bury a body in the woods. Just from that right there, you can tell that Tim Dowling has got quite a sense of humor. He moved to her native England. He became a father. He accepted a position as a weekend columnist for one of the big papers there. And he now works from home as a house husband. And he takes on, in his writing, the most basic and mundane ideas, answering the door and all sorts of do-it-yourself tasks, the kinds of things that make him, if not a good husband, then, well, at least a relevant one. In this part of today's show, we're going to be talking with Tim Dowling about his book and about life as a husband and a father. And he describes it really in tremendously entertaining sorts of ways. He's got 40 guiding principles of gross marital happiness, which turn a lot of our ideas on their head. One of them being, go to bed angry if you want to. It's a bit like going to bed drunk. You wake up feeling completely different, if not necessarily better. And he's got the 12 labors of marriage, including cooking. It's not uncommon, he says, to marry someone for love alone, even if that someone can't cook at all. My wife did, and so did I. Almost everything we know about cooking, we learned together through a series of hideous culinary accidents. We'll have more stories and entertainment from Tim Dowling when Positive Parenting continues right after this.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this, from the MrDad.com radio network.
My name's Tyler, and in 9 years, I'll be an alcoholic. I'll start drinking in middle school, just at parties. But my parents won't start talking to me about it till high school.
Kids who drink before age 15 are 5 times more likely to have alcohol problems when they're adults.
The thing is, my parents won't even see it coming.
So start talking before they start drinking. To learn more, go to StopAlcoholAbuse.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the Ad Council, and this station.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and my guest for this part of today's show is Tim Dowling, who's the author of How to Be a Husband. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about why you feel that you need to tell people how to be a husband.
Well, you will notice that it's called How to Be a Husband and not How to Be a Good Husband or How to Be a Better Husband. This isn't so much a self-help manual. It's basically a memoir about hanging in there.
Okay. So you're not, I mean, that makes it even more intriguing. So not how to be a good husband, but just how to be a warm body?
There's more to it than that, I suppose. Someone called it a self-hinder book because it's basically a list of mistakes that I've made over the years. I mean, every day for me, being a husband is a lesson in what I'm doing wrong. Still.
Yeah, it can be. It can be. Of course, I'm not a husband at this particular moment, so I can't. Maybe it's because I should have read your book. But
I'm not sure. Maybe.
So let's talk about some of the mistakes here. You've got the book divided into a number of different sections of guiding principles of marital happiness and labors of marriage. Let's talk about some of the guiding principles. You say that there are 40 of them. I'm not going to be able to get to all of them, but what are some things really to focus on?
Well, I think one of the big ones that struck me, that I feel like I've learned, is that people often say that there's this idea that a couple should never let the sun go down on an argument. And I just think after 10 years of marriage, I thought, you know what, you should go to bed angry if you want to.
Oh, yeah. You should go to bed angry?
Yeah, if you want to. I think when you're faced with this choice between, you know, closure and a good night's sleep, you're better off with a good night's sleep almost every time.
Well, I like the way that you put it, that it's kind of like going to bed drunk. You wake up feeling completely different, if not necessarily better.
Yeah.
I guess. So what would the marital equivalent of a hangover be?
But I mean, I learned it largely from lying awake at night thinking, God, I've got to resolve this. I'm never going to sleep if I can't resolve this. And I'd lean over to my wife and she'd be fast asleep. You could hear her snoring. And I just thought, if she can sleep through this, then I can sleep through this.
And how long have you been married? You said...
It's 22 years now.
Wow. And so you moved from where in the United States?
At the time, I'm from Connecticut originally, but at the time I was working in New York. So I was living in New York in a sort of squalid little apartment.
So your wife had to take you completely out of the country to get away from that apartment?
Absolutely. The idea that she would come and live with me at that point was not on the cards.
Yeah.
But I sort of, yeah, I met her in New York and she was there on vacation, and I sort of followed her back. I mean, I think I rocked up in London about a month later.
Okay. And so you're working as a columnist for one of the English newspapers, right?
Yeah, for The Guardian.
Okay. And what's the column talking about?
Well, the column is this. The column is really, they gave it to me about 7 years ago. Someone else had stopped doing that page, and they sort of left it up to me, and they said, we don't want you to feel that you have to write about your own life. And I tried not to for about 3 weeks, and it sort of kept intruding. You know, I thought I couldn't think of anything else. And so it is largely about the sort of week-in, week-out humiliations of being a husband and father.
And I was actually really intrigued by something, kind of, you know, going through the book. How you make the transition from being an American sports fan to being a British sports fan? Because, you know, we don't know Chelsea or Manchester United unless you listen to the Rod Stewart song that happens to mention them both.
It was a long, hard road. When I first got to this country, I was frightened to go outside a lot of the time. My wife was at work, and I didn't know how to ask for things in shops, and I would wander around and think, if I go too far, I'm going to not be able to find my way back. And I sat inside the whole first summer, and I watched the cricket. And when I started watching it, I couldn't tell whether they were playing or whether they're just waiting to start. It's impossible. It's just a bunch of guys in white standing around. And that goes on for 5 days. And sometimes at the end of 5 days, it's a draw.
And why
do they just go, oh, well.
Why do they call it a test match?
That's a good question. I'm not really sure where the sort of term test comes from, but I think it's just a sort of abbreviated version of the word contest. You know,
it's the same way
they call an FA Cup match, they call it an FA Cup tie, whether it's a tie or not. I mean, it just is a sort of, it's like a fixture.
I remember years ago, I was in England traveling around, and I was sitting on a train reading a newspaper, and there was an article in there about a cricket match.
Mm.
And I remember thinking, did I just have a stroke? I can't understand English anymore. I should be able to make more sense of this. It meant absolutely nothing.
I still have to rely. I mean, when my children were small and they would want to go outside and play cricket, I would go out and play with them, and they would start ordering me around because I never know where I'm supposed to stand. And the positions are called things like silly mid-off and silly point and long leg, square leg, fine leg. And I still don't know where these places are. And it technically depends on whether the batsman is a right-handed batsman or a left-handed batsman, because he's off and leg are, alternatively in front or behind him, depending on which way he's facing. So the whole field switches around when you bring on a left-handed batsman. I mean, it's a nightmare. If you have to have a diagram, I would go out with a little diagram in my pocket if I could.
I'm not even sure that they play cricket. Actually, you know, there is a thing called the Sticky Wicket Cricket Club. I remember their commercials. They are here, so if you want to learn how to play cricket. But let's get back to some of your foibles and mistakes and things like that. So you start off with kind of what we talked about. One of the first rules is don't be like me.
Yeah.
How has your wife felt about this venture of yours?
The book, you mean?
Yeah, yeah.
I think she's always been very sanguine about the column, which has gone week in, week out for 7 years now, and she thinks she comes out of it pretty well, and she doesn't seem to mind. But I think this was an intrusion of a different order, the book, because going back into the past and writing about what a terrible husband I am makes it look, you know, like she's made a terrible choice. And also, I think people have a sort of personal ownership of the past. You know, I would show her these pages at the end of a week and, you know, some seminal event in our relationship and that I found very sort of emotional, and she'd read the whole thing in silence and then hand me back the papers and say, I don't remember any of that at all. You know,
that's...
there's certain things that I considered significant that she simply didn't stick in her memory.
But she's clearly got a good sense of humor. I mean, to be able to, I mean, most of it's laughing at you, of course, but there's a little bit of her.
I think that's what I'm here for.
Oh, to be laughed at?
Yeah, well, but to be laughed at by my wife.
And how about the kids? Are they old enough to understand what's going on with this?
Oh, I mean, yeah,
just,
they
just
are
the
now.
Idea that you're kind of making a career out of making fun of yourself.
I think they know that. And they were very small when I started doing the column, so there was a long time before they didn't really know what I did for a living, because obviously they went off to school every day and I stayed here. And at the end of a sort of working day, I had very little to show for anything when they came back from school with their sort of loosened ties. They said, "What have you been doing?" I'd say, "You know, well, I've been, you know, putting words on a page." They couldn't think of a more boring way to use a computer.
Talk about cooking a little bit and the horrors of learning how to cook together.
It was, at the beginning, my wife and I, neither of us could cook at all, and we didn't care. We went out, we ate terrible food, and in those days we drank and smoked a lot, and it seemed to be fine. And then after you get married, you start to have people over for dinner, and we just got sort of tired of having to apologize all the time at the end.
To each other or to guests?
To the guests. So, I mean, very, very slowly we learned to cook, one meal at a time. We bought some cookbooks. We took turns. We had a bunch of, hideous accidents where nobody could eat anything we'd made. But we very, very slowly developed a sort of 7-day rotation. Now both of us can cook. She's a very good cook now. She couldn't cook at all when I met her. And, I can get by. But we've invented a lot of these. We have one recipe that's just called Mexican, and I mean, it's not remotely Mexican. And it can't be more specific than that, because it's not.
What is it?
Burrito. It's not an enchilada.
It just has hot sauce on it. Whatever it is.
Yeah, it's sort of a mess. It has refried beans in it. It requires 4 cans of refried beans.
Well,
and after that, it gets very hard to explain.
Okay, I'm talking with Tim Dowling, who's the author of How to Be a Husband. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to keep talking with Tim about some inventive ways of being a husband, or we might say how not to be a husband. I'm Armin Brott, and you're listening to Positive Parenting.
This heavyweight bout is about to begin. The challenger wears white trunks with a blue stripe, and the champ is wearing, looks like an examination gown from the doctor's office. And from the back, we can... Ooh, that's not pretty. Champ, what's with the crazy getup?
I've got to take care of my family.
Yeah, so?
Well, when you love your family, you got to go in and get those important medical screenings. A lot of potentially deadly diseases can be treated if you catch them in time.
So you wear the examination gown because...
Because I'm a real man. Real men take care of their families and get those tests. Real men wear gowns.
Okay, champ. Good luck. Here we go. The champ's not wasting any time. Oh, it's over. This fight is over. Champ, you barely broke a sweat. Any words for your fans out there?
Remember, go to ahrq.gov for a list of the tests they need to get and when to get them.
What was that web address again?
ahrq.gov. And remember, real men wear gowns.
Go to ahrq.gov. This message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AHRQ, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Tim Dowling, who's the author of How to Be a Husband, and wanted to have you switch over just a little bit about, because with you, you've got 3 boys, and, well, it doesn't matter whether the 3 boys or not, but part of being a dad is setting a good example, and you talk about this a lot in the book, something that probably hits every father. Like, you try to set a good example, you try to do all the right things, and then you look and you say, they're not doing any of that, and somehow they're turning out okay.
Yeah, and good. I think that's really good. I mean, the thing about setting an example is, well, I'd really like to be able to sort of turn it off. You know, like when the TV stops setting a good example for them, you turn it off. But with me, it's like, you can't really just say, can you stop watching me now and for the next half hour? You know that thing where you pull up to a toll booth and you suddenly realize you haven't got any money? That's the kind of thing I don't handle very well. I tend to panic. And if you've got 3 kids in the back and you can feel their eyes just watching you, I find it creepy. Actually, it's a little creepy that they think that I'm a role model.
So how do you handle that, though? I mean, if they're, you know, they're looking to you, and if you scream at a waitress or throw something at somebody, I mean...
If I screamed at a waitress, I would, yeah, that would be really bad. I've never screamed at a waitress. It's more what, it's more how, I don't know how, not every man handles unfeeling authority in the same way. But, you know, having my credit card declined in a store, that sort of thing. Just those little humiliations, which I know they find, now they find incredibly amusing because they know that my reaction is panic.
And they must have been for you incredibly embarrassing.
And it's very embarrassing. Yeah, they love to watch me squirm. I guess there's something about it that there's nothing. I don't understand why it's funny. You know, I don't see the funny side.
So, but do you think that they're secretly calling up the credit card companies and telling them that it's stolen? So just to see you.
to spark an incident.
You talk about something that's, I think, rather poignant. A lot of these things are. I mean, you're doing it tongue in cheek somewhat, but there's a lot of stuff here. One of them, you should never feel so secure in your partnership that you are unable to imagine the whole thing falling apart over a long weekend. I mean, that's a funny line, but it's also really kind of makes you think about the importance of trying to work on a relationship.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not trying to make men paranoid or anything, but I think complacency is the more dangerous enemy in that situation. The idea that you're really secure and that nothing, your marriage, a lot of people say, yeah, my marriage is rock solid and all that sort of thing. And that's, you know, lots of divorced people have said that at some point.
Talk a little bit about sex and things not to do as a husband. Well, just go on for a few minutes. No, I mean, you know, the chapter in the book, a very short chapter about sex. And it is a very short chapter. It's about 3 pages.
I would have made it shorter if I could. It's not the kind of thing, my wife is not very keen that I write about our sex life. And I think if you read it, you'll see that it isn't really. It's,
oh, no. Yeah. But is it something, it's obviously something you want to keep private, something, you know, what are your general ideas about it, just without getting into any of the details?
Exactly. I think the main thing is that the basic strategies for maintaining a healthy sex life are not, in and of themselves, terribly sexy. It's just, it's got a lot more to do with things like emptying the dishwasher without being asked than you think it does. I mean, no one is sorrier about that than I am.
It's a terrible analogy. Jeez. I mean, you're not exactly, but I can imagine. So, my sex life is just about as exciting as emptying the dishwasher.
And I think with people, there's a lot of not having sex in marriage, you know.
I mean, you're spending, if you added up the hours, you're spending a lot more of your time not having sex than you are actually having it. Yeah.
Me specifically, you're probably right. But I think people could comfort themselves. If you look at any kind of sex survey, you find that actually most people aren't having very much sex these days. And if you're married, you're probably having more sex than most single people, you know.
What was the hardest part about marriage for you? Or what is the hardest part still?
I think the hardest part is that you really realize that it's a sort of constant, you know, your life isn't your own. And I think you have to... Obviously, you are not. You don't only have that burden, but you have the burden of being that to someone else. That you're sort of intrusion into that person's privacy and space, and you know, their dreams of a better life, I suppose. But it helps to sort of think. I think if you think that you resent, sometimes you know you can build up a lot of resentment about how your life is going because it's not running on the tracks. That necessarily you're not necessarily in charge of the train. It sometimes helps to remember that you're also resented on some level. But I think it's obviously better to be married. Certainly for me, it's better to be married than not to be married. I'm not leaving. I'm not going anywhere. But day to day, sometimes you just, day to day, everybody wants their freedom. They want to do what they want to do. And every decision you make in marriage is two people making it.
Now, you talk about early on in marriage, it's kind of important to have some sort of a signal that's going to say,
"Oh yeah,"
which kind of reminds me of you know, discussions that I've had at various points about let's have a word or a phrase or something that we can use that basically means can't continue to have this discussion right now because I'm about to go through the ceiling. Let's talk about it in an hour.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you also just have to have that thing where you meet people at parties and you have to have that signal that you can raise an eyebrow and then it means, please use this person's name in a sentence. I have forgotten it.
That's such a great line. I mean, it's like, that's the problem with not being a husband, is I don't have somebody like that around except for my daughter, who is quite happy to show me and show me up at any moment. Yeah.
Well, I've got that. Everyone here is happy to show me up at any moment.
Yeah. And if your wife were writing a parallel book, do you think that she would? You mentioned that there were a number of the things that she read in the pages as you were going through the book that she didn't remember at all. Do you think that she would write, if she were writing a book about how to be a husband, that she would cover some of the same territory, or would she have completely different ideas?
Oh, yeah, she'd cover the same territory. I mean, a lot of this, what's in this book, comes from her. You know, she knows, she's not shy about pointing out my shortcomings. In fact, we have a little sort of quarterly self-assessment where she just runs through my manifest inadequacies, which is part of the privilege I have of being a sort of inadequate husband, is that she's happy with that as long as she's allowed to sort of sit me down and tell me about it from time to time.
Now, you spend a lot of time tinkering and doing stuff and fixing things. How does that play into your husbandly role?
It's funny because the word husband has this weird, old-fashioned connotation of husbandry, which is like basically being a householder. I mean, and in the old days, it would involve looking after animals. But I don't have any sheep or anything. But you have this house, and you're sort of in charge of it. And if you work from home like me and you write all day, you don't have that real sense of going out there and conquering anything. And I do like to take a hammer to my house on occasion, just to work out some issues and fix things. And sometimes when I fix things, they end up being slightly more broken than when I started.
Well, what are some of the things? You mentioned that there are five things you can actually fix by hitting them with a hammer.
Yeah, it took me a long time to come up with five. I came up with three. The other two were very hard ones. But a couple of them are, you can fix, very often if your central heating system is stuck, if the pump is stuck and none of the water isn't going through, they say that if you tap the actual face of the pump with a hammer, good and hard, it will sort of free up the blades inside, the impeller, I believe it's called.
Impeller.
I once spent a day sort of tapping it with various sort of rhythms, and nothing happened. In the end, I called a plumber. He came out, and he took out a bigger hammer than mine and hit it once, and off it went. He charged me £40 for that.
That's great. A bigger hammer, that's what you need.
Yeah. Hammer, yeah. You got to be a plumber to have one of those.
So what's,
well, you can do
what's
your car starter motor if it's, sometimes the brushes get worn and you turn the key. One of those terrible times you turn the key and nothing happens. You think the battery's dead, something's gone. But it's worth getting out of the car and having a tap, if you know what the starter motor looks like, giving it a tap. And sometimes it just allows the brush inside to make contact. The only time I did that, and it did work, I had to go down there with a picture that I downloaded off the internet of a starter motor so I could find the starter motor in my
exactly
car.
Where to hit it, yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
I hit a lot of stuff.
We're just about out of time, but I want to ask you about family meals, because I think so many memoirs of family talk about the wonderful warm times that we had as a family and all the stuff that gets accomplished, and there's all sorts of research about how important family meals are. And you talk about kind of the other side of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think they are really important and central to life, but the idea that they go well is a sort of myth, I think. I mean, we had a sort of tolerably successful Sunday lunch today, but it lasted about 20 minutes, which is about, if you get 20 minutes out of teenagers, I think you're doing well. Most of the time it ends with two of them sort of screaming at each other and some, you know, a plate gets turned over and my wife says, "You're all horrible," and leaves and goes off.
Tim Dowling, the author of How to Be a Husband, thanks very much for joining us. Really entertaining. Great stuff.
Thank you.
If we could pack our kids in bubble wrap, we'd do it. Because we love them, and we want to protect them. This is Lisa Edelstein with an easy way to protect your kids three times a day. Choose healthy foods. Research has shown that a vegetarian diet rich in fruits and vegetables can help protect our kids against obesity. It can even help keep them from developing heart disease or cancer when they grow up. To learn more, call 866-906-WELL or visit cancerproject.org. This message brought to you by the Cancer Project.
Did you know 26 million Americans have kidney disease and most don't know it?
The day I was diagnosed, I didn't know what to do. I called the National Kidney Foundation, and the young lady who answered stayed on the phone with me and walked me through step by step. She too was surviving kidney disease. And she showed me there could be life after kidney disease.
Visit the National Kidney Foundation at kidney.org. Now, you know.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. Every once in a while, I get an email that really kind of brings a tear to my eye, and this is one of them. Dear Mr. Dad, my dad is an engineer and has always looked at the world in a very logical, no-feelings-allowed, Mr. Spock kind of way. I guess that's just his style. The problem is that I don't think he's ever told me that he loves me. He always has been a great dad, and I have no doubt that he does love me, but as I get older, I'm nearly 30, I start second-guessing myself, and I really need to hear the words. I tell my kids all the time that I love them. Why won't he tell me? Do you think he ever will? Whenever I get an email like this, I am really nearly overcome with sadness. I think it's tragic that your dad has never told you that he loves you, but I'm encouraged that he's found other ways to get the point across and that you've gotten the nonverbal message. That still leaves your questions. Going in reverse order, yes, I think he will tell you, but it may take a little work on your part. As to why he hasn't said those three magic words, there are quite a few possible explanations. Judging from your age, I'm guessing that your dad is in his mid-50s or older. That puts him at the tail end of a generation in which real men didn't show their feelings very much, expressing emotions or being in any way in touch with their feminine side. I gotta say, I really, really hate that expression. Was, well, feminine. If that's the case with your dad, I'm sure those lessons were passed down to him from his own father, who most likely was a good dad, too. For most men of those generations, being the provider-protector was exactly what it took to be a good father. Unfortunately, it was also all that was allowed. Not expressing feelings doesn't make them go away. The proof is that, magic words or not, you know that your dad loves you. He may just be embarrassed to put words to the feelings he clearly has and has opted to show you by doing things. I know that might sound crazy to today's young parents, but there's a bit of socialization that's really hard to shake. It's also possible that with his scientific mind, your dad may not even realize that not hearing the words is hurting you. In his mind, expressing love by doing is a lot more important than telling you. So, what do you do? First, ask yourself when you last told him that you love him. He may have been waiting to hear those words too. It doesn't matter who says it first. What's important is that you're both aware of each other's feelings and acknowledge them to each other. Next, come right out and tell him how much it would mean to you to hear him say that he loves you. He may just mumble in embarrassment, "Of course I love you, honey," or he may be genuinely surprised when he realizes that in all those years he never actually said the words. Hopefully, your dad will become a bit more talkative about his feelings for you, at least for a while. But if he doesn't, keep in mind that part of being an adult is not only living with disappointments, but also appreciating what we have. You happen to have a dad who's not very verbal, but whose love isn't in doubt, and who shows his feelings in a way that truly matters, through his actions. And actions, as we all know, sometimes really do speak louder than words. If you've got a question or a concern or a comment for us here at Positive Parenting, we would absolutely love to hear it. We try to respond to every email that comes in or every message that comes in. You can reach us through our website, MrDad.com. You can also follow us on Twitter, at MrDad, or on Facebook, Facebook.com/MrDad. Are you getting a theme there? We're also on LinkedIn and Pinterest, as you might imagine, having something to do with Mr. Dad. We'll be back next week with another Ask Mr. Dad segment or Parents at Play segment, depending on what exactly our schedule is like. In the meantime, do feel free to check out our archives of columns. You can get them at MrDad.com/ask. Speaking of archives, we also have several years' worth of shows up on our website, and you can check those out, MrDad.com. Just look for the archives for the radio show segments, and you can get going back 2 or 3 years at least. But don't go anywhere quite yet, because there is more Positive Parenting coming right up.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this, from the MrDad.com radio network.
It kind of freaks me out that some people actually go through their trash to pull out recyclables. That's not for me.
Maria Inez Phillips talks about not recycling.
I've got too many newspapers and magazines and catalogs in there with plastic containers and bottles and cans.
In your recycling bin?
No, in my trash.
Your trash can is full of recyclables?
No, it's full of trash.
You say trash, Maria. I say rubbish.
Whatever it is, I'm not going through it. I don't even know what they do with recyclables.
They make more of the things you use, Maria. More newspapers, more bottles and cans.
Out of a bunch of trash? I just don't get it.
Some things are very obvious, Maria. Recycling creates jobs and protects the environment. Is that important to you?
It is, which is why I put my trash where it belongs.
Learn the difference between trash and recycling and more on our website, yougottabekidding.org.
I put out way too much trash to think about recycling.
See why recycling is not rubbish. Visit yougottabekidding.org today.
Now, get ready for more positive parenting with Armin Brott from the MrDad.com radio network.
Hey there, welcome back to the second part of today's Positive Parenting Show on the American Forces Network. I'm Armin Brott. What do a tangle of ingenious riddles, a malevolent necklace called a torque, flocks of menacing birds, and a stubborn writing desk that refuses to reveal its contents have in common? You wouldn't think that they really have all that much in common at all, right? But they do. They're all obstacles that stand between Gabriel Finley and his father Adam, who has vanished from their Brooklyn home without a trace. Let me tell you just a little bit more about the plot. So Gabriel rescues an orphan baby raven named Paladin, and he discovers a valuable family secret that could possibly lead him to his father. And what that is that the Finleys can bond with ravens in an extraordinary way, sharing their thoughts and speaking to one another, even merging into one being and taking to the air. Along with Paladin and three of his friends, Gabriel sets off to bring his father home. All of this is taking place in a really terrific book called Gabriel Finley and the Raven's Riddle. It's an epic fantasy adventure that's filled with unforgettable characters and seemingly unanswerable riddles and astonishing bursts of magic at every turn. And we're going to be speaking with the author in this part of today's show. He's an award-winning writer and has written several other books for adults. This one happens to be his first one for kids, but it is also for adults as well. I sat down and read the whole thing cover to cover. We'll jump right into Gabriel Finley when Positive Parenting continues right after this.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this, from the MrDad.com radio network.
McGruff the Crime Dog here. Let's hear from an identity thief.
Identities are easy to catch online. I send people an official-looking email pretending to be their bank or credit card company and ask them to confirm their personal information. Books them every time.
Safeguard your personal information on the phone, online, and especially at home, because half of identity theft occurs by someone you think you know. Keep your identity to yourself and take a bite out of crime. Learn more from the National Crime Prevention Council at ncpc.org.
A message from this station, the U.S. Department of Justice, Crime Prevention Coalition of America, and the National Crime Prevention Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and my guest for this part of today's show is George Hagen, who is the author of Gabriel Finley and the Raven's Riddle. George, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Armin. It's a pleasure.
Let's talk about riddles. There are so many riddles throughout this book, and it really became kind of an interesting exercise. I read it myself. I mean, I was going to read it to my daughter, who was busy with other things, so I just started myself, and I didn't put it down. So it's not only for middle schoolers. It's for adults, too. Where did you get this idea of weaving riddles into the story and making them really an integral part of the thing?
Well, you know, I was trying to think of something. I wrote this for my daughter. She was 10 at the time. Her name's Lola. And I was trying to think of something that a kid could do that was very empowering, something that maybe would be perplexing to adults, because that kind of thing in a story is really fun. At least I enjoyed it when I was a kid. And I thought riddles would be great because most adults don't really have patience for them. And if you tell your parents riddles, you know, they tend to be busy and a bit distracted, and kids love them. It's a really it's the sort of the triumph of wit over age, you know. And I thought that was a nice thing to have in a story.
And there's different kinds, though. There's some that are funny, and some that are puns, and some that are neither.
Yeah, I love the humor in puns. They're incredibly silly. They're almost achingly funny. You know, some people just groan at them. But that kind of cleverness is sort of a delight. And so, yeah, I tried to mix them up, to have some that would be just double meanings, and others that might tie in more to myth, because that's another very powerful thing for children, I think. Viking myths and Greek myths.
Oh yeah, no, that's certainly something that's kind of magical. It's kind of interesting. It's kind of historical. It really, in a way, brings so many different things together.
Yeah, and in fact, in a lot of mythology, there's always someone who's a wit like that. Ulysses was a wit that way. When he tricks the Cyclops, he leaves him with a riddle. And Odin from the Norse legends was also an incredible wit that way. He told a lot of riddles too to fool his enemies.
Well, then there's the oracles who speak in riddles. They don't manage to get a simple idea across in a simple way, but they've got to get you guessing on everything. Let's talk about ravens, since that's the other main kind of character. So we've got riddles going throughout here, and then there's ravens, and I'm kind of fascinated by the whole process of where ideas come from. So you talk about ravens versus crows and senses of humor being only certain kinds of ravens, but talk a little bit about ravens and how they happen to end up in such a starring role in the book.
Sure. Well, when Lola told me that she wanted me to write her a story, and I agonized over this for quite a few months because I hadn't done a children's book before, and one of the books that we used to read a lot together was Alice in Wonderland, and her favorite parts in this book is the Mad Hatter's Tea Party. And during the tea party, there's a very famous riddle told.
Why is a raven like a writing desk?
Why is a raven like a writing desk? And of course, you know, the most frustrating thing about it and the most distinctive thing about that scene is that there's no answer to it. And I thought, wow, that's really interesting. I like the idea of ravens, and I like riddles anyway. And then there was the notion of why is a raven like a writing desk, and that was kind of the foundation for my book. I decided, well, this book is going to have all three. It's going to be an exciting adventure story. It's going to have ravens, riddles, and writing desks. So then I fixated a lot on ravens, and I didn't know that much about them, so I read a book that was about studying them in the wild, and it was absolutely fascinating. And it turns out that they're sort of the dolphins of their species. They're extraordinarily intelligent, and that just got me. At that point, I thought, I've got to have ravens in the book. So that's what I did. I decided that there would be good ravens and bad ravens, and the story began to write itself at that point. It was just a wonderful combination.
Well, you talk about the difference between ravens and crows. What is that?
Well, my understanding, and I'm not a scientist, is that, first of all, ravens are a little bigger than crows. Second, they are much, much smarter. And the third thing is that they look different from them. Ravens have black beaks, black eyes, and black claws. Crows don't quite look like that, and they don't have such prominent beaks. And ravens are able to make an extraordinary number of sounds. They're mimics, just like parrots. I don't believe crows are. Crows can make that caw sound, but they don't have a lot of flexibility in the types of noises they can make. Ravens, on the other hand, have an amazing vocabulary. They can make all kinds of tweets and throcks and clucking sounds, and they can also imitate human beings. They can imitate phrases, which is astonishing.
Really?
Yeah.
No, that I had no idea about. I mean, I had heard that in the wild they were mimics, and that would be partly they would be using that to trick other birds into doing different kinds of things. But I had no idea they could actually mimic speech. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, you can actually explore YouTube for raven moments, and there are a number of pretty amazing little videos where they imitate people. It's
raven hilarious. Moments, that's great. But you also created in the book kind of a new species, I'm guessing, of vowel ravens. Where did those come from?
Well, you know, I guess the notion of vowel ravens is actually in Viking mythology as these bad creatures. I kind of took that idea because I liked the sound of the word, and I thought, well, it would be really good to have my villains be a type of raven too, a raven that's basically done the one thing that my ravens would never do, which is betray their best friends. So I thought, well, I'll invent this history between them, between the vowel ravens and the ravens, and it's 1,000 years old, this idea that they've been pitted against each other. And so I thought, well, vowel ravens will be ravens who have bitten the flesh of their human companions. And since the code of friendship exists between ravens and human beings, to break that code is about the worst thing you can do.
When you're writing a book for middle schoolers, and this is, I'm asking you as somebody who's written, I mean, you're the person who's written a number of books for novels for adults, how do you begin to decide what kind of a vocabulary you're going to use and what's appropriate, what's inappropriate? I mean, you happen to have a middle schooler around the house, or an almost middle schooler at 10 years old. So, but it you know, people kind of think that they can write for kids, and most people can't.
Yeah, I have to say that I don't feel as though I've mastered it. I you know, it's trial and error. I mean, I have the advantage, I think, as a parent, of being able to say across the dinner table, "What do you think if I did this?" You know, and I either get a surly glance or I get a that could work, that could work. You know, so when I hear something like that, that's encouraging. So it's like, you know, it's good to have your own 10-year-old coach in the room. But I think otherwise, I spent a lot of time going back and thinking about stories that made a big impression on me as a kid. And I have a pretty good memory for the books that first kind of captivated me. And I remember reading The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe by C.S. Lewis and really liking the notion that you could be in a world where animals can talk. And I think that was something that I wound up exploring more with Gabriel Finley because that was so appealing to me as a kid.
Did you just read it over and over again?
I did. I mean, I have. I could probably recite one or two of the scenes in that book. It just, you know, it kind of it becomes just one of those things you never lose.
Talking with George Hagen, who's the author of Gabriel Finley and the Raven's Riddle, and we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll keep talking to George.
Bullying is not kids being kids.
It's not about good homes or bad homes.
It's not a normal part of growing up.
I shouldn't be afraid to get on the school bus.
To turn on my computer.
Message. A lock to my locker.
Did you know that a bully will stop his or her behavior in 10 seconds when their peers speak up?
Use your voice.
Hey, leave him alone.
We have the power to stop bullying.
Find out more at bullying.org.
Where you're not alone.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with George Hagen, who's the author of Gabriel Finley and the Raven's Riddle. George, thanks for sticking with us. Wanted to ask you something. I noticed one of the things that hit my eye on the cover of the book, right at the very top, is a blurb from Norton Juster, the author of The Phantom Tollbooth. And The Phantom Tollbooth was, I guess, my version of your Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I remember reading that book from front to back, and then starting all over again. It was just an amazing thing. And I imagine, you know, you probably had heard of or knew of anyway, Norton Juster. What was it like to get him to give a comment on your book?
I have to say that, you know, I told my wife after I found out I found out about Norton Juster liking the book. I thought, well, I can just rest now. Almost didn't need to see the book published. I was so thrilled because that book made an incredible impression on me. I'd actually I moved from England to the U.S. when I was about 11 years old, and Phantom Tollbooth was one of the first books I read when I came to America, and it made an amazing impression on me because it was such a combination of abstractions and wonder, and I think, like you, it just, you know, it was one of those books that I turned back to over and over because the sense of humor in it is unique.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's very educational in a lot of ways, and in a completely transparent sort of way that you would never expect it. But the, you know, the witches and the TikTok and, you know, witch, that kind of thing, and then vowels disappearing, and there's a whole marketplace for consonants and stuff. It's, you know, just really, I thought, it's so creative and so, well, you don't appreciate, I think, the creativity until you're an adult. When you're a kid reading that, it's just fun.
Yes, I mean, and also the silliness in it. I mean, I think silliness is actually a very important part of children's books because, you know, life kind of gets less and less silly as you get older. And I remember the one scene where Milo jumps to the Island of Conclusions. I would read that over and over again. I just thought that was such a marvelous concept.
Jumping to conclusions, yeah.
Jumping to conclusions,
exactly.
Yeah. And each time he did it, he would wind up back on the island. He'd have to get back again. And it was great, just wonderful.
You know, I know what you mean about feeling that you can rest. I had wrote years ago a letter to Lloyd Alexander. I'm sure you know the name, who wrote the Black Cauldron and a number of other books. And those were also like
brilliant.
Right. If I were ever able to take a break from the Phantom Tollbooth, I would be reading the Black Cauldron books.
Yeah.
And he wrote me something back. It was just like one of my prized possessions. I'm not sure where it is now, but just to have like a handwritten note from Lloyd Alexander, it was like getting some, you know, some message from God or something.
Yeah.
I mean, just as, wow, he exists. He knows who I am or something. And I don't know. It's kind of cool.
Yeah, I think I had very, very similar feeling about Norton Juster. It was almost as though, you know, he was this voice on top of a mountain somewhere, you know, because I couldn't imagine a real person could have written Phantom Tollbooth. It was just too clever.
Now, you mentioned sitting across the table and asking your daughter, hey, does this work or does that work? How involved was she in the plot of the book? I imagine she probably didn't do a lot of writing.
No, she didn't do any writing, but she, you know, this is the dilemma. You know, the story was intended to be kind of a treat for her, too. So I couldn't tell her too much because I didn't want her to know what the plot was. So I would ask questions about, well, what would you think about the idea of there being good ravens and bad ravens? And what if, you know, the only way a raven would greet another raven was to tell a riddle? You know, what would you think about that? You know, and so she would say, well, that sounds interesting. That sounds possible. So I would give her little clues like this, but I tried to avoid the plot itself because I really wanted it to be surprised the first time. And so I was sort of on edge when she finally read the book, and she got to the end of it, and she sort of nodded. And she said, "That's good, Dad." But you know, it was not exactly. I wasn't sure if it was a real endorsement until she started recommending it to her friends, and then I thought, "Okay, I made it. It's working."
Wait, so she made the comments on the published version of it, or did you show her a draft before you turned it in?
I actually showed her a manuscript even before I dared show it to any other adult because I thought, well, this is the real crucible, you know. I've got to make sure a kid likes it because, you know, if an adult likes it, that all that tells me is that I've written an adult book. But if a kid likes it, then I know that I've written a child's book, you know.
Right, and kids are not, they're not grown up enough to just say, oh, this is really great, unless they actually mean it. Because if you want this is really great, you just ask your mother, and then you'll get this is really great. And you know, so tell us, George, a couple of riddles, something that we can kind of get relatively simply because we're listening and less people are going to rewind this and go back. But give us one of your favorites out of the book.
Sure. Well, there are riddles which are sort of conceptual, and there are riddles that are puns. I mean, here's one. What can you take from someone but never keep? And the whole idea is, what can you take, but it's not necessarily an object. And the minute you start thinking about what else it could be, the idea is that your mind makes that sort of mental leap and thinks about other kinds of concepts of taking. And the answer to that, do you want the answer?
Well, I mean, I remember from the book, but I was thinking that there's so many others. If you start thinking about that, it could be time. It could be, I don't know, other promises.
Yep. Yeah, you're quite right. And time, that is another variation on it. But it's true that in some cases, the fun thing about a riddle is if you can come up with an answer that isn't necessarily the riddler's answer, and it still fulfills all the requirements. Which is why I think that's the other cool thing about riddles, that if you can come up with your own answer and it fits the bill, then you've almost trounced the riddler.
There were some really nice puns in there as well. Can you give us one of those?
You know, I don't have one from the book that I can think of off the top of my head. I can think of a couple of puns that, there's a classic pun when is a door not a door? When it's a jar.
Okay, right.
That's a pun. And puns are basically they're like the building block for any riddle, because anything that has a double meaning, either in the question or the answer, works very well. And a classic. Oh yeah, well here's a classic one. Why can you never go hungry in the desert? And the answer is, well, the pun is in the answer, not in the question. Why can you never go hungry in the desert? Because of the sand which is there. Sandwiches.
That was in the book, I think, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, that's actually a really old, really, really, really old riddle.
And where did you get these things? Were they just, you know, I imagine you can go on the internet and just, you know, look up riddles, but you were carefully selecting ones that fit with the plot as well.
The interesting thing about riddles is they're like any kind of activity where if you haven't done them before, they seem really difficult to do. And at the beginning, I was using ones that I had heard before, and then I realized at a certain point, no, you've got to be more original than that, because otherwise this is not fair. So I would start making them up, and I found the first couple took me days. Many days. And then as I did more of them, my head started to get comfortable with the notion, and I found after a while that I could start making them up fairly quickly. So it was almost like a muscle. You know, the more you build it up, the better you get at it. It's the same thing, I think, people find that with crosswords. You do your first crossword puzzle, and it's an agony that takes a week. But after a while, your head kind of adjusts to it. You know, the brain is a very pliable thing, and with a little exercise, it can do amazing things.
And you put your daughter's name into a riddle in the front piece, rather than having a traditional this book is dedicated to, you had there's four paragraphs, so you end up with four different letters, which I'm not gonna tell people. They should get the book and find out for themselves.
Yeah, that was fun, actually. I thought it was only fair, actually, that I put a riddle at the beginning as a kind of a warning to people who opened it up, that they would know what this book was going to be full of.
George Hoggins, the author of Gabriel Finley and the Raven's Riddle, really terrific book for middle school kids, but also I think for adults. You get a lot out of it. George, thanks for being with us.
Thanks very much, Armin. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Positive Parenting. You can get more information on today's show and what we're working on in the weeks ahead at MrDad.com. While you're there, visit the MrDad.com gift shop with everything you need to help you become the dad or mom you want to be. Positive Parenting is a production of the MrDad.com radio network. Now, go be a great parent.